Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's David Summers once again, and it's another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So let's step back into the ring and step back into time as we get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, how's everything in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee?
Oh, man, a little cloudy today, but warm. Got a nice little warm day, so I can't complain about it. In two each life, some rain must fall every once in a while, so might be going to get a little bit today.
Wow, you're a poet. I didn't know it, but my feet show it. They're long, fellas. Okay.
Hey, that sounds like me too, man. I'm a long fella too.
Yeah, I bet your feet are longer than mine. All right, so Leah, yeah, cloudy and gray is what we've had with not so much rain, but warmer temperatures. That's good, and so I think maybe the groundhog was right. So maybe we can.
I'll tell you what, I am getting here though, man. We're getting the big tourist already.
Oh wow, yeah.
Yeah, traffic here is crazy, man. And wow, they're coming from everywhere. It is definitely the most visited park in America.
Absolutely. All right. You seeing any bears out lately?
I saw one last night. I saw a picture of a guy who was sitting in his hot tub, and he said, "You know, I really like it here in the mountains. It's really, really good." And behind him there was an open door. He was in like a little garage looking thing, and there was an open door, and there was a bear standing in the door behind him. And he was going on about, "Oh boy, this is so beautiful. This is great. I love this." And I'm thinking, boy, you're not in a minute.
Yeah.
You're not going to love it. So, they're out, my man. Bears are there. I think they're over there. Hibernating is done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just hard to get over the temptation to hug the little bears.
Yeah, right. As long as mama's not near.
Yeah, maybe so. All right, listen, stud, your studcast are absolutely on fire. This one today is number 340. 340 of these. That makes more than 6.5 years altogether. And after all that time, your unique podcasts are more popular than ever. So, I mean, does that surprise you?
Well, yeah, it certainly does, Dave. I have to admit, man. I thought, man, in 2018 when I did my first one, that I'd maybe do 8 or 10 and see what people thought of it. And each week that I did those 8 or 10, the audience grew big time, each one of them. So, so I thought I'd go on until the fans listening kind of dropped off in numbers. I figured that was going to happen. But that's never happened.
Wow. Not only has it not happened, your studcast has reached a new level in the last 3 weeks, than it's ever been. Your recent episodes have definitely challenged Google's claim that after Vince McMahon Jr. told everybody that wrestling was scripted, it didn't matter, and consequently, the sport became even bigger than it ever was when McMahon Jr. took it over.
Yeah, well, once I saw that statement in the Google article, then I saw that Vince, you know, was trying to avoid paying the state tax on the boxing and wrestling commissions, and he had killed the territories, and I knew there was no way that wrestling became bigger after the collapse of the territories than it had been for that basically 60 years, you know, before Vince ever came along. A lot of people were watching televisions across the country. A lot of people were really involved in their territories and loved them big time.
Well, the numbers you provided to prove your point were absolutely astounding, especially his loss, and I thought this was really fascinating, of 10 million former fans from 1985 until today. Former fans who walked away from the sport, attendance-wise and especially on TV. This studcast is titled, now this one, the one we're doing today, is called Georgia Jawjacker, Armstrong, and Farmer Burns. So tell us what's up with all that.
Well, I mean, that's a very odd title here, but we're going to explain it during the course of this. I think people are going to figure it out. But we're going to begin basically with another hidden history lesson, and that's where Farmer Burns, the Farmer Burns part of this, starts us off. And then we're going to finish with the arrival of a masked man in 1980 in the southeastern Gulf Coast territory called the Georgia Jawjacker. And fans went crazy for this dude. that's about the best I can say about it. So last week I said, you know, I was going to begin this hidden history lesson with my grandfather, Roy Welch, back in the 1920 time frame, after he had spent time training with the original Dutch Mantell, who was one of the best shooters in history. But, you know, Dave, I can't resist going back even further to give fans a little bigger taste of the history of the sport, that, you know, that this is an extremely interesting group of wrestlers way back in the 1800s. And it's going to lead us perfectly to Roy's 1920 time frame, which we'll probably be getting into in the next studcast. So we're going to start in the 1880s, when all wrestling was real, unquestionably. There were wrestlers from all over the world competing in different weight classes with several different styles of wrestling. They had the Greco-Roman, you had the Jiu-Jitsu, you had the catch-as-catch-can style. That's only to name a few of them. And then you had some of the most famous wrestlers in the years from 1800 and 1890s, Farmer Burns, like Evan Strangler Lewis, Tom Jenkins. And then in the 1900s to 1920, you're going to have Fred Beale, George Hackensmith, the Great Gama, Stanislaus Zbyszko, and the most famous of all of them, Frank Gotch, who was at one time considered the most popular athlete in America. So in these years, from 1880 to 1920, professional wrestling was worldwide. I mean, it was a big deal all over the world. It was definitely real. It drew massive crowds, such as one of them, over 100,000 people to see Zbyszko wrestle the Great Gama in London. And 30,000 plus to see Gotch versus Hackensmith in Chicago in 1908. But the matches were few, and it had none of the nonstop action that we're going to have here in the future days. It was very, very time-consuming matches. That's a good way of putting it, I guess.
Wow. So,
Dave, let's begin, man. Let's just take right off on this. We'll jump right on Farmer Burns here, you know.
Okay.
And they called him Farmer because, one reason, he was from Iowa, big farming country. And mostly because he wore farmer overalls when he wrestled, you know? but I can tell you, this guy was no joke, man. He was no country boy when it came to wrestling. He's the real thing.
All right, so why did you pick somebody named Farmer Burns to get this whole thing started?
Well, because, you know, he was one of the greatest of his time. He was not a big guy. He wasn't powerful and didn't have the big muscles. But basically, he was the first to discover that great technique always was going to win over strength. And he trained over 1,000 shooters during his life. And he was the first wrestler my grandfather ever talked to me about. when we were on those trips going to Memphis, and he would sneak me out with, and shoot Rob and Jimmy with the BB guns and with the pistols. And, you know, then, you know, he talked to me about this Farmer Burns. So, and there's one more reason, Dave, one that almost makes Burns feel like family to me. Farmer Burns trained, one of the guys that Farmer Burns trained in 1905 was the original Dutch Mantell.
Wow. Wow.
Dutch Mantell trained Roy. Roy trained most of my wrestling family. And I always felt the connection to Farmer Burns through that lineage.
Okay. So, I mean, that's really cool. So your family really, in a way, you go all the way back to the 1880s in the sport?
Yeah. You know, yes, I feel kind of like that. We do.
Yes,
you know?
Wow.
Burns taught the Mantell taught Roy. I mean, you know, so there, I feel like there's a connection kind of with Farmer Burns. And the Farmer Burns story is a tremendous one. I mean, he trained himself using his own techniques, developed in his way to his first try. He got him ready for his first try at the American Heavyweight Championship of a guy named Evan Strangler Lewis in 1885. Now, Strangler Lewis had one hold that he was famous for, and that hold had won all of his matches for him. And obviously, since he was called Evan Strangler Lewis, the hold was very close to a stranglehold. But it was not considered by the referee to be a chokehold. Therefore, it allowed him to attain these victories for years using that hold. So Strangler Lewis won that first encounter with Burns in 1885, and he beat Burns with his hold. So Burns spent, this is crazy, Burns spent the next 2 years continuing to develop his skills in the sport and his wrestling skills, but also to build his neck muscles until he had a 20-inch neck. And now he didn't stop until he could put a hangman's noose around his throat on the end of a 6-foot rope tied to the ceiling and jump off a platform and hang himself for minutes.
Are you serious?
In fact, his hangman drop, he called it, during the time he was hanging, he could whistle Yankee Doodle.
Wow. That's crazy.
It is crazy. And he used to do it for people as an exhibit. He let people watch him do it. So 2 years later, then in 1887, he wrestles Evan Lewis again. And they wrestled for the Catch-as-Catch-Can American Heavyweight Championship. Lewis got his hold this time, just like he did the first match in 85. But, Farmer Burns' neck, man, proved to be the difference, man. So Burns ended up winning the championship from Evan Lewis in 1887, and he held that championship for 10 years until 1897. So from 1900 to 1920, the sport changed, as the sport has always changed. Mm-hmm. And it went from the many styles of wrestling that were back in the 1880s and up into the early 1900s. It went to an American style called freestyle wrestling. That's basically what you see today. So Farmer Burns was no longer wrestling for championships at that point, but he was the undisputed best trainer in all the world. He trained as many as 1,000 wrestlers over the 10-year period before he finally disappeared from wrestling. And his most famous trainee was a guy named Frank Gotch, who many say was the greatest wrestling champion of all time. Some of the greatest matches of all time took place during this era, too. So Gotch wrestled all opponents, including the most feared one from Estonia, George Hackensmith, who was called the Russian Bear. They wrestled twice between 1908 and 1911. Mm-hmm. Now, the first match they had was in Chicago, 1908. to highlight the difference between wrestling at that time and what was coming in the 1920s. The two wrestlers in this match, Dave, did not go off their feet a single time for the first 2 hours of the match.
Wow. I want to make sure I heard you correctly on something. They didn't go down on the mat a single time. You said for 2 hours?
For 2 hours. God. The first 2 hours of the match, right? I mean, this is the way things were back in those days. Wrestling was real, and, you know, they didn't take any chances on losing, so they just it went long periods of time. And yeah, you heard me correctly. I mean, that's crazy, you know? So it was truly another day in time. And we're going to get to that subject soon here, you know. But the Russian had heard of Gotch's trainer, Farmer Burns, before this match. And how Farmer Burns had trained himself. And he did his best to avoid getting taken down. That's why they went on their feet for 2 hours, is the Russian just blocked and blocked and blocked and blocked. And they didn't, he never let Gotch take him down, because he knew if he got took down, he was going to get beat, because he knew that Farmer Burns had taught Gotch a toe hold that was a devastating hold. It made him champion in America for 10 straight years, that toe hold. And he knew Gotch knew that hold. And, you know, so, He didn't want to get finished fast, and so he stayed on his feet for as long as he could. So during the course of this 2 hours, Gotch used another pretty unorthodox technique, which is what Burns was famous for teaching. Mm-hmm. And he drove the Russian into the corners of the ring and onto the ropes. And every time he got him there, he would headbutt him until the Russian was bleeding so badly. He was bleeding all the way down to his trunks, you know. So after 2 hours on their feet and the Russian bleeding profusely, then Gotch finally took him down. He rode him for about 3 minutes. And while he was riding, he was going for his toe hold. And he was about to get it. Now, Hackenschmidt was a big, huge, muscular guy. So Hackenschmidt knew that he was about to get the toe hold. He was blown up. Gotch was in much better shape than Hackenschmidt was. And about the time, just before Gotch got the foot, Hackenschmidt gave up, said, "I give up," to the referee. And it was supposed to be a 2 out of 3 falls match. But they went to the dressing room. Gotch came back for the second fall. The Russian never came back for the second fall.
Wow.
Wow. So they met again 3 years later. 1911, Chicago's Kaminsky Park, in the big baseball stadium, 30,000 fans, more than 30,000 fans. It had a record gross house of $87,000. You have any idea how much that is in today's money? We're talking about a 1911 house.
$87,000 in 1911?
Yes.
Versus what is today's money?
Yes.
I can't imagine. I would have to say at least over the $1 million mark.
$6,109,845.
Wow.
Is what Google says.
Yeah. Wow.
So, and Gotch won again. He won this second contest too. So it was the last time these two ever met. So the Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine, which was big back in those days, magazines, and the wrestling magazine must have been one of the first ones, they called Gotch the best North American professional wrestler of the 20th century. Basically, Gotch was so popular that he was right up there with the boxer Jack Dempsey and the baseball player Babe Ruth.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, that's really amazing stuff, but... How are you, and fascinating to go back that far, but how do you follow this like next week?
Well, I'm going to take us into the roaring 20s. We're going to start with 1920, and basically everything changed in America, basically in the roaring 20s. And Americans were changing dramatically in every way. So they were no longer wanted to see these matches that lasted hours after hours. That didn't have very many holes and even less excitement. So the sport itself was about to dramatically change. After Gotch's popularity, more athletes were wanting to participate in the sport, but they couldn't find a way to get into it. So next week, we're going to go back to my grandfather, back to Roy, and he's going to be arriving in Ohio to begin his career as a professional wrestler. And we're going to be going to work for a new star that had the shot to be the top of the sport. And that new star is a guy named Ed Strangler Lewis. Not related to the Evan Strangler Lewis, but Ed Strangler Lewis. And I think he probably took Evan's name because Evan had been so famous like 30 years earlier. Yeah. And Ed Strangler Lewis is going to be the new world champion. And then the next one, we're also going to meet the carnival wrestling star. We talked about the carnival wrestling already. The star of all carnival wrestling was a guy named Joseph Toots Mont. And then we're going to talk about a third wrestler, and this guy was a promoter also, a guy named Billy Sandow. And between the three of these guys, they are going to totally change professional wrestling forever. And they became known. They were so smart in what they did. They built the first territories across the country way back in the 1920s. And they became known as the Goldust Trio. Wow. And after them, wrestling would never be the same again.
Wow. I love these hidden history lessons. This one has been truly amazing. And next week's sounds like it could be even better. What a great start to this Studcast. I know you have another surprise in store for us today, and it has something to do with someone returning to the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory. So before we go to our break, can you give us the card? Let's go back to Mobile, Alabama. Tuesday night, March 4th, 1980. Break that down for us.
Okay, so the opening match on that night was Roy Lee Welch, and he was wrestling against a highly regarded newcomer, young guy that was making a big name for himself, Dr. Bill Irwin. Charlie Cook and Eddie Boulder were teaming up. They were going to take on the Big C and Bill Dromo. Joe LeDuc was facing off against the fabulous one, Don Fargo. That had to be crazy. In a match for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, former champion Tony Charles was going up against the new champion, Randy Rose, at this point. Then in a Southeastern Tag Championship match, the champions, Jimmy Golden and Norvell Austin, were defending against my brother and I. And it was going to be the last chance for us to win the belts back. In fact, that's what it was called, the last chance match. And in the last match of the night for the Southeastern Championship, the Mongolian Stomper, manned by Don Carson, was going to be wrestling against a new masked man called the Georgia Jawjacker.
All right, that's a great card, but that main event was really a mystery match, I think. At this point, no one in the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory had ever heard of a wrestler called the Georgia Jawjacker. Now, I've heard you tell stories about this before, so I know what we're talking about here. So when was the Stomper and Carson, when were they going to find out who the Jawjacker was?
Okay, well, that's going to be on the TV show, man. And let's go ahead and take the break here. And when we come back, I'll lay it out for everybody.
Oh, cool deal. All right. So this has been a great part of this Studcast, this first part. A lot of fun. I think I remember this TV show way back in 1980. It was one of the first Southeastern TV shows I think I ever saw. And I was wondering who the Georgia Jawjacker was. So I can't wait for this one. Stay with us, folks. We're going to be back. And when we come back after the break, get ready for the introduction of the Georgia Jawjacker on this Studcast. All right, Studcast fans, good news for fans in the old Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory. Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, is making a rare appearance in the Ozark Civic Center, Ozark, Alabama, Saturday, March 23rd, 2024. It's a free meet and greet with all fans and a night of professional wrestling featuring Wildcat Wendell Cooley, Scott Armstrong, and the local stars of that area. Meet and greet begins at 6 p.m. when the doors open, and the stud will be available throughout the night with photos, t-shirts, his lion novel Brutus, and his USA Championship belt that you can have your picture made with. There's a rumor going around that he may be escorting one particular wrestler to the ring. You gotta see it. Saturday night, March 23rd, Ozark Civic Center. Be there. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back in. The second half of this Studcast is really going to be a good one. So here we go. This should be a very interesting TV show, Stud. So lay it out for us. Tell us how it all got started.
Well, it began with Tony Charles, and he was joining Charlie Platt at the set, and they watched a video of his loss of the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship to Randy Rose. And it was on that recent World Championship card that we talked about just a week or so ago, with the 10,000 fans in Mobile's main arena with me against Harley Race. And on that card, Randy Rose had won Tony Charles's Junior Heavyweight Championship. So they watched about the last 5 minutes of that match, and Tony had the only lost that belt two times in 3 years as the champion. And he was very happy to get an instant return match with Rose for the belt. And the video basically showed the reason why he got it. So it showed many close-ups, many close pins. And this was a fast-moving match. These guys were great wrestlers, both of them. And the last 5 minutes, they ended up with a lot of false finishes. Guys would kick out of pins and get out of finish holes. So they ended up with Tony Charles. He shot Rose into the ropes. He sidestepped him when he came, and he shoved him into the ropes. And then he O'Connor rolled him, man. Beautiful move. Pat O'Connor, former world heavyweight champion's move. He O'Connor rolled him. He came up on top. He's basically sitting on top of him. And Rose's shoulders are pinned to the mat. And then the referee dropped down there on his stomach. He started to count. Well, when he's on his stomach, he can't see what's going on up above there. And at the count of two, Rose reached up and he grabbed Tony's trunks and he pulled him backwards to reverse the hold. Tony had Rose pinned, but when he grabbed his trunks, Tony lost his balance. He went backwards. And as he was falling backwards, Rose just clamped onto his hips, and it automatically brought Rose up on top of Tony. He's in the same position. So Tony ended up on his shoulders and Rose sitting on top of it. Now, the obvious difference here was very clear. Rose had a handful of Tony's trunks, man, at this point. And he, you know, he just hung on to what he had and he never let it go. And the referee down there, face first on the mat, he never even looked up. He counted him out. So Tony, being the class act he was, you know, he thanked Don Curtis for seeing this tape and awarding him an instant return match and the opportunity to regain his title and the belt the very next week. And so Charlie invited Charles to stay with him because Randy Rose was going to be in the first match of the show. So Rose had garnered, as we talked about in the last few weeks, he had really garnered a lot of heat, man, and but it was nothing like he got, man, when he came out of the dressing room and TV, and he had that United States Junior belt, and he strutted up into the ring and around over his head to the fans there. Wow, he had them. They were going nuts. They wanted to kill him. And he didn't waste any time when the match got started on his opponent, man, and he kind of took it out on him, man. He was doing these clotheslines, man, the forearms across guys' throats. And boy, he shot this guy in and he clotheslined him like he had been doing. And so he got the pin and then he grabbed his newly won belt and he had it over his head, but he didn't walk toward the fans and the bleachers. This time he walked over to where Tony Charles' side of the ring. And he told Tony, you could hear him yell real loud. He says, old man, come and get it. Well, that's all it took. Tony Charles was a go-getter, man. I mean, so he darted for the ring, man. He slid under the ropes, but before he could get up on his feet, Randy Rhodes had shot out on the floor and shot into the dressing room. Guy, the belt and all, he was gone.
I can certainly see where Randy Rhodes was getting better each week, not only as a wrestler, but as a heel, too. And I bet he and Charles had some great matches. All right. So who was next after that one?
Well, it was a very hot heel team, man. The Southeastern Tag Champions, Jimmy Golden and Norvell Austin. And while they were champions, and they kind of had the same routine, man, they came to the ring with their belt, to the set. And they got to watch their victory from four nights earlier, which was on the same world title card as the video that had just been watched by Tony Charles. Got a lot of video shot on that night with all those 10,000 people in that building, and made great videos for a future, man. Made the territory look big, and it was big. So he got in their match. They were wrestling against Rob and Eddie Boulder, you know, because I'm wrestling against the Harley Race for the world championship. And they got a real strong win over Eddie Boulder right in the middle of the ring, Golden and Austin. So then they made their claim that the upcoming championship match with Rob and I, this is where they got into, this was going to be our last chance. They said this is going to be the last opportunity that these two Fuller boys have to win this championship back. And if they don't win, they said, we're never going to defend against them anymore. And we've talked to Don Curtis, and he's going to let us do that. He's going to make this. If they don't win this match, they're never going to get another chance to win the belts from us. So, and if that didn't get enough heat, man, then they paraded around the ring in front of the fans on the bleachers, man, with their belts held over their heads.
Well, of course they did. All right, so how about the next match? Who was in that one?
Well, their opponents for the next week, Robert and I. So, in a way, we were getting our first chance, man. And at the same time, our last chance for a return match for the belts, and that they had basically stole from us in a cage match 3 weeks earlier when they had the double cage night. Don Carson had helped them steal the belts from us in that cage match. So Rob and I had everybody in the studio standing, man. We went in and tore our opponents apart. And Rob ended up, we put both of them in the Fuller leg lock, and we got another really good win the second match.
All right, so let's go to the personality profile. Set that up for us.
Okay, so Don Carson and his Southeastern champion, Mongolian Stomper. Charlie was already at the set. They came out of the dressing room. So Stomper had his big old huge truck shock that he used to squeeze. And he was already squeezing that. Carson came to the set. Carson was all fired up. He started off by asking Charlie, he goes, who is this mass wrestler called the Georgia Jawjacker that my champion here is going to be defending against this week? Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of name is that? Who is this guy, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And he wanted to know, who's this guy ever beat? He started into that, and he said, who did he beat to deserve a shot at the champion? My Mongolian Stomper. He goes, on any night, much less his first night in the territory. He goes, what's wrong with Don Curtis? Is he crazy or what? So then he says, they said, my Stomper's the best wrestler in the world, and it's absolutely ridiculous to put somebody called the Georgia Jawjacker in the ring with my Mongol. So studio crowd, they booed him like crazy. So, and that just, that got Don fired up and made him madder. So Charlie couldn't get in a word, man. Carson just rambled on. He kind of took the whole deal from this point. And he told Charlie, he said, I need to speak to Don Curtis. I need to tell him that neither he nor his Stomper, are going to be responsible for any injuries that this so-called Jawjacker is going to get in this match. We're not paying for him if he sues us after the Stomper kills him, but we're not going to be responsible for it. So, and then he said, you know, last week he said they finally ended their problem with this idiot lumberjack from Canada, Joe LeDuc. Mm-hmm. He goes, you know, we had that I quit match, and he goes, Stomper knocked the dummy unconscious. And he said he couldn't even say the words I quit because he was unconscious, you know. And he said, and now they want my monster, you know. Basically, he's referring to Archie, who's back there pumping that truck tire behind him while all this is going on. And he goes, they want my monster to wrestle a Georgia jawjacker for the championship. And then he goes, why, that jawjacker, he said, he isn't going to be able to even get back to the dressing room when he finishes this match, and much less win a championship for my stomper. So the crowd booed him again. So, and he didn't care. He just went right straight on, you know. And he said, I may even let my good friend, the Big C, take care of that jawjacker and give my mogul a night off. So he said, I'm just totally disgusted with this. And he said, and I'm considering leaving Southeastern. If a Georgia jawjacker is the best they can do down here to get competition for my Mongol, I might just leave here. And boy, with that line, he got a big cheer. Everybody says, yeah, go on, get out of here. So that was basically the personality profile.
All right, so a very different personality profile. So who was in the next match on the show?
Well, man, a fan favorite, man. At this point, you know, they loved him, Joe LeDuc, man. And on his way to the set, he dropped by. On his way to the ring, he dropped by the set to say something to Charlie, you know. And he was kind of chuckling to himself about the Georgia jawjacker because they could just... That profile had just ended. So, and he told Charlie, he said, you know, he says, I got to tell you, Charlie, he said, I had a chance to get another shot at the Stomper, you know. And he said, but, you know, I want to see how this Georgia jawjacker is going to do, man, and his shot at the belt and the title. Hmm. So then he went on to the ring, and obviously made everybody happy. He put the bear hug on the guy, and then he won most of his matches, he bear hugged the guy until they had to carry him out.
Wow. All right. So how about the last match on the show? Set that one up for us. I got an idea who it might be.
Well, man, it's time to see who the Georgia jawjacker is. So, you know, and his opponent's already in the ring, well, along with the announcer. And when he comes out of the dressing room, I mean, his face, he's wearing a mask, right? So obviously his face is hidden, but man, there's no denying whose body it was, man. And he had this strut in his step, man, and that told everybody exactly who he was, even before he got in the ring, man. Mm-hmm. Even though he'd been gone for 3 months, they hadn't seen him in 3 months, everybody in the studio went nuts. They jumped up, man, their hands were clapping, they're going crazy. You couldn't hear the announcer even say what his name was. So, and it's crazy, you know, and crazy was exactly what Don Carson and the Stomper were at this point. And they went running to the set with Carson and Carson at the set with Charlie, and Carson was screaming, that's Bob Armstrong. That's Bob Armstrong. That's no Georgia jawjacker. He goes, he's not supposed to be here. He lost the Lose or Leave Southeastern match. What's he doing? What are they doing here? He was just beating and hammering on the desk. Stomper, dude, couldn't take it. He just hit. He went straight for the ring. He bolted right into the ring. And as soon as he came through the ropes, the jawjacker started on him. And wow, I'm telling you, the fans were still up because they were so into who the jawjacker was. They were so excited that all hell broke loose. I mean, then Golden and Austin came and got in the ring. Rob and I, we went to the ring. Randy Rose went, Joe LeDuc went, Tony Charles went. I mean, it just turned into total pandemonium. The fight lasted about 5 minutes, and all of a sudden the heels had had enough, and they headed for the dressing room. So the rest of us went to the set with the jawjacker. It's his time to talk, man. And, you know, it's going to be his first ever Gulf Coast interview wearing a mask.
Right.
So studio men were still on their feet, and they were roaring, man. And the jawjacker, I mean, he tore into Don Carson and the Mongo Man, talking about who they were, the big C, you know. And he says, you know, C stands for crap. You know, and he was on fire, man. And I mean, so show ended up, wow, it was a tremendous end to the entire show.
That really had to be one of the wildest endings maybe to any Southeastern TV show in Knoxville or even the Gulf Coast. So what happened the next week in all the towns and territories?
Well, everybody went, man. Everywhere we went that week, all three of the major markets, the Montgomery, the Mobile, and the Dothan, as usual, they were all full, man. And even Pensacola and Panama City, and we always had ran one smaller city during the week to get those six nights, and even the smaller city, every one of the buildings were full. It was crazy. After having this world championship deal with 10,000, now the buildings are full again following that.
Okay, so how about Mobile's Expo Hall? I think it's going to be the following Tuesday night.
That's correct. We're on Tuesday nights. Used to be Wednesday. We've been on Tuesday for quite a while at this point.
Yeah.
And so the Georgia Jawjacker wasn't the only one in the building, man, to make a great first impression. The new wrestler, Dr. Bill Irwin, shows up. He's wearing a black cowboy hat. He's carrying a rope, a cowboy's rope, to the ring. And he's a heel. And wow. And Roy Lee was really... Fans really loved Roy Lee. Roy Lee was a darn good wrestler. But, I mean, this Irwin destroyed him. It was ridiculous. I watched it. I was like, son of a gun, this guy's going to be good. And then when he won the match, he started tying Roy Lee up with the rope around his arms and getting his feet behind his back. And, you know, and the referee tried to stop him. And so Irwin just grabbed the referee and threw him out of the ring onto the floor. And went back, tied Roy's arms and hands behind his back, and then left him laying there on his belly, went to the dressing room. So that got pretty good. Got things started off pretty decently.
All right, so I think I remember him. He was a young guy, and he always had a rope with him.
Yeah, yep, that's him. And, you know, kind of blonde hair and, pretty good wrestler. He was always using that rope for something. So the next match was Charlie Cook and Eddie Boulder against Bill Dromo and the Big C. And so Cook and Boulder got a win over Bill Dromo because the Big C did the same thing he did in the last tag match he had. He left Dromo in the match, left him in the ring by himself, went to the dressing room. And so Dromo got beat, and, fans didn't matter. They liked the fact that the Boulder and Cook got their hands raised. So Joe LeDuc was in the next one against Don Fargo. And, wow, I think the Duke got a real surprise in this match. He underestimated Fargo, man. And Fargo was a tough old son of a gun, man. And Fargo ended up having Joe bleeding, you know. First time you'd seen that, seen Joe bleed when it wasn't a stomper at the man responsible for it. And the match got stopped by disqualification. And so we went ahead and booked that match back again for the following week with a no disqualification. And then the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Tony Charles regained his title and his belt. And before he got out of the ring, Randy Rose attacked him. You know, he was the referees helping him put the belt on. He wanted to wear the belt going back to the dressing room. And Tony Charles attacked him. He threw the referee out, and he threw Charles over the top rope. And then Charles had dropped his belt. He took Charles's belt, and he took it to the dressing room with him. So then in the Southeastern Tag Championship match, Rob and I, we managed to beat Norvell Austin. And Robert put the Fuller leg lock on him. And in spite of the fact that Big C came to the ring with these guys, with Golden and Norvell Austin, managing, wanted to manage a team that he wasn't supposed to be responsible for. And then he got involved in the end of the match. If it, you know, it wasn't enough that he got to hang out there, he had to get involved. So we were declared the winners and the new champions. That's going to be the second time we'd been champions since January 15th of 1980, when we beat those Mongolians to win the belts for the first time. Fans were ready, man, for the last match with the Southeastern title, the Mongolian Stomper, managed by Don Carson, which was on the line against the Georgia Jawjacker. The returning hero, man, with a new identity. So at the end of that match, the Jawjacker was doing just that. Well, he had Stomper in the corner, and he was standing up on the second rope, and he was jacking his jaw. Wow, it was ugly. That building was going nuts, and Stomper couldn't handle any more of it. In desperation, he was going to lose. You could tell he was going down. He was sagging down the ropes. He was going headed down, but he just grabbed the Jawjacker by the leg, and he dumped him straight over the top rope for an automatic DQ. So the match, you know, was going to be returning the following week. We were going to be wrestling again, and this next one is going to be a no DQ on that match as well.
All right, so really a pretty wild night. A cowboy using his rope to tie his opponent up after beating him. Big C leaving his partner again. Joe LeDuc getting busted open by someone other than the Stomper. That's crazy. Tony Charles winning his belt back, then losing it again. Big C still showing up in yours and Robert's match. And then the Jawjacker winning one of the first matches back. So how about attendance for the week? It had to be pretty good with a setup like that.
Well, Montgomery had 4,000. It had fallen off a little bit, but it was still a full building. Dothan was 4,300, full building. Mobile had that record world title crowd the week before, 10,300 in the main arena. Expo Hall didn't hold that much, but Expo Hall had a sellout at 5,600. Pensacola, we hardly ever remember these towns, Pensacola and Panama City. Pensacola, because of this, the Jawjacker showing up, Pensacola had a 4,100. And Panama City had 3,600. Monroeville, Alabama, a little tiny town north of Mobile, had 3,100 people, man. So the total for the six-day week was almost 25,000 fans following the World Title Week. So if we had 52 weeks of that kind of week, we would have 1,300,000 fans for the year. So there weren't many territories doing that kind of numbers, man, in 1980.
1,300,000 for the year. That would be, wow, what a projection that would be. All right, so another great one. This has been Ron. And believe it or not, we are going to have enough time for another Learning Tree question. This one comes from Dennis Compton, Seattle, Washington, about as far from here as you can get in the contiguous U.S. He says, I love the When Wrestling Was Wrestling post that you regularly do on your social media sites. The last two featured Harley Race and a photo of you and Andre the Giant from the 1970s. It appeared that you had thousands of views and comments. So how do you deal with that and also do a studcast every week?
Well, that's a great question, Dennis. I'm not sure I know how to answer that myself, man. So it is pretty crazy. So it takes me about 3 days of research to get ready to do a studcast, depending on how far back I have to go. And luckily, you know, I saved the TV formats from all the years of my television shows. I wish I could have saved the shows. That would have been even better. But they covered who was in the matches, who was in the interviews, who was on the profiles. Often they had notes about, what was being said and, what had happened in the match and who won the matches. The information, a lot of information I got from those formats. So this studcast has been a great example of wrestling history, you know, and I could have no knowledge of any of this stuff I talked about in the early part, except for my grandfather and Google, of course. Google's got everything there if you need it. And and I needed it to go back and see for myself about the 1800s, late 1800s. Now, I'm as fascinated as hopefully the listeners that have been about to learn about these sources and to learn about that matches, these matches that were had back in the time frame. So these studcasts, they're kind of like they becoming a part of my life, man. And hopefully they're going to be a source of wrestling history for many years to come when something happens to me. And the wrestling was Wrestling Post. They're relatively new. I think the guy's name was Dennis. They're relatively new stuff compared to how long I've been doing these studcasts. And in every one of these, as I do them, I talk about a match that I had on a certain date years earlier during my 18-year career. And you're right, Dennis, about the last two I did. One was about a match with Harley Race. And in fact, in the last studcast, it was talking about that 1980 match, sold out the Mobile Arena, 10,000 plus people. You know, we did one on that, and I had a picture of Harley Race. And on the other, it was about the first trip that I made to open up Dothan, Alabama on my birthday, March the 3rd, 1978. And Andre the Giant came with me. We rode through Atlanta, flew through Atlanta, changed planes in Atlanta, came into Dothan, Alabama. And so it was a picture of me and Andre shaking hands. So the Harley one, this is crazy, Dave, but the Harley one had a photo of Harley, you know. And as soon as I put this When Wrestling Was Wrestling post up with Harley Race's picture and a little bit about that date and, how many years ago it was, that match, it blew up, man. I mean, I had thousands of fans. It was like, wow, within 20 minutes, I'm like, son of a gun, what am I going to do here? Because I like to try to answer people, you know. So, and it was fans from all over the world, and they're making these comments. It went on for days about how great Harley was. It just turned, it opened the door for fans to relay to me their feelings for Harley Race. And wow, that in itself is a real, it was a real great honor for me to see how much people felt about Harley, how much people appreciated Harley Race, And then in the Andre post, I used that picture of me and Andre, right? And as soon as I put that picture up with me and Andre, it blew up again. But it blew up this time, it's kind of like the Harley post did. But this time, it was about how tall is Andre really? The discussion starts and it goes thousands of comments and from all over the world. And again, thousands of fans, they start discussing whether Andre is he really 7 feet tall or more? Ron's supposed to be 6'9". He don't look like it, you know, and they're all discussing amongst themselves and sending this to me, and the controversy still going on. I mean, this is like a week later, it's still happening, you know, on my Facebook and on my Twitter, or X, as I guess that's what it's called now, you know, and I'm so amazed at wrestling fans and how well they communicate with each other. I mean, there's these long trails of discussions between I think he's 7'2". I don't think he's 7 feet. It's like, wow. So before I end this, Dave, I'm going to put up another When Wrestling Was Wrestling post. And I'm going to do it today, later today. It'll probably come out sometime tonight.
Cool.
And I'm doing it after this cast has been released. Obviously, we're going to release as early as we can in the day, but I will wait and put this post up later. And I don't know the exact date that this photo was taken that I'm going to be putting up on this post. It's going to have to do with Martin Farmer Burns. And then and the picture was taken somewhere in the late 1800s. It had to be, right? And this picture is something very special in it, man. And obviously it has to do with Farmer Burns. And it's basically going to show, this is crazy, man, but it's a picture of him actually hanging, doing his deal.
Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, rope around his neck and arms all straight out to the side. And I assume that he's whistling, you know, the song too. And so I can't wait to hear what I'm going to get on this one when the people get to see this picture. So I'd like to thank you, Mr. Compton, from Seattle out there. And I hope I answered your question adequately. But we could probably easily spend the rest of the day talking on this subject, because it's been pretty crazy for me and my social media lately. And so for those men who are not already friends with me, Dave, I'd like to make a little announcement here about how they can get in touch with me on Facebook or X. If you would kind of explain, please, how they can become friends, so they can take a look at this post that I'm going to put up later today.
Absolutely. So what you're doing, Ron, for fans all over the world is truly amazing. So if you're not already friends with Ron on Facebook, there's only one site that can accept you. Please go to Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud Facebook site. Like, follow him there, automatically become friends with a living legend. If you're on Twitter or X, go to Ron Fuller Welch. Follow and like him there, and you are in. I really hope, and I know you are, going to enjoy this special post that's coming later today. This has really been another great one, Stud. The hidden history lesson today was outstanding. So much wrestling history that very few fans have ever heard. So where are we riding next week on another extraordinary Studcast?
Well, man, we're going to have a continue with this hidden history lessons, basically about the beginnings of professional wrestling. We're going to start with 1920 in the next one, basically where we left off today. And we're going to find out why and how the sport changed from real to what it's going to become. And my grandfather, we're going to be following him as he lived his dreams, man, of becoming a professional wrestler. And in the Studcast, we will also be finding out what some of the younger family members are doing 60 years later, man, in the second week of March, 1980. So we're going to talk about Welch's in the first part. And then 60 years later, we'll be talking about what was going on in March of 1980. Plus, we're going to find out how the Georgia Jawjacker was getting over.
All right, good deal. All right, again, on Facebook, everybody, find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a legend. Twitter or X, Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there, too. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com, tnstud.com. This Studcast is going to be there with every Studcast ever done. Stop by the Stud Store, where you can get 43 Super Studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. Subscribe now at YouTube Southeastern Rewind. Get the best in old school wrestling. Find 404 videos, the last 117 Studcasts, 52 Stud stories, 106 short rides with the Stud, and now 14 Ask the Stud question and answer shows. There is a ton of stuff on YouTube, Southeastern Rewind, exclusively. It's the best deal in old school wrestling. All right, any final words, Ron?
Well, I want to thank everybody that listened today, obviously, tell your friends and neighbors that are podcast listeners, man, about us. You know, they might enjoy what we do here. Please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud LLC. Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.